Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein here on this sunny, windy, and pretty cold first Friday. Today we're going to be talking to renowned Juno photographer Mark Kelly, who's going to share some of his images of Denali, Glacier Bay, the Pribilof Islands. That'll all be part of his presentation at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center tonight for the Friday Fireside Lecture Series. We're also going to be learning about the Indian Islands Institute and hear about their shindig that's happening tomorrow. That's going to be Zach Brown here. And we're also going to get a preview of the Gospel Singing Workshop and maybe even hear a little singing. It's all going to be happening at the Jack. That's all coming up, plus bird note, music, more, all coming up. But first, here's National Native News.
With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton in for Antonia Gonzalez. The new owners of Indian Country Today Media Network promise a hands-off editorial approach as they revive the publication that went dark in September of last year. National Congress of American Indians Executive Director Jacqueline Peta says NCAI will publish the online news site, but it will not be involved in editorial decisions. NCAI advocates for Native American issues and organizes lobbying efforts with federal government leaders. Peta says the public needs a strong, independent Native news source.
An educated public actually helps make better decisions and inform their policy decision makers about the needs of Indian country and the solutions. And I think it also makes a big difference for us wherever we are in Indian country, whether we're in our rural village of Alaska or Navajo or, you know, in an urban center, to feel like we have a connection.
The previous publishers, the Oneida Nation, donated Indian Country Today's assets to NCAI. The new publication will operate as a nonprofit. NCAI hired veteran journalist Mark Trahant as editor. Trahant, who is Shoshone Bannock, says he wants to be partners, not competitors, with other Native media.
We're going to be trying to cover the whole country. One of the, I think, ways we'll be doing that is working with a lot of partnerships. One of the things I'm kind of setting up from the very beginning is that all of our content will be free use, so anybody could use it as long as they credit us.
He is currently the Charles R. Johnson Endowed Professor of Journalism at the University of North Dakota. Trahant is the former editor of the editorial page for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, recently held its very first two-spirit powwow, which is believed to be the first of its kind on a tribal college campus. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
The Kumpka Gym on the Haskell campus was packed as grand entry was underway for the first two-spirit powwow held on the campus. One of the many participants in the event, Amanda Trujillo, expressed her emotions.
Well, as a pansexual woman myself and a supporter of the lesbian gay community, as well as being a full-blood Native, I was compelled to come out here, and this is my first ever two-spirits at powwow. I'm just absolutely thrilled. It's awesome.
Haskell student and organizer for the powwow, Bryce Smiley, said he was overwhelmed with the amount of support they received.
It's just a traditional powwow, as I was told. So just to see the show out, it's really, really awesome. And just to be around your own peers, people who identify the same as you, it feels like a safe place to be. It feels like home, to be honest.
President of Haskell, Dr. Vanita Chenault, was also in attendance and happy they could host the history-making event.
Well, I think it reflects our values that we talk about in terms of respect and recognizing the diversity within our communities here at Haskell. We've got, I understand, visitors from Florida, California, Illinois, Missouri, all coming to support this event.
Funds for the powwow were provided through a grant from the American Indian College Fund. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
No Native-themed films or Native actors are up for Academy Awards this Sunday, but veteran actor Wes Studi is tapped to present an award during the televised ceremony. Studi appears as Chief Yellowhawk in the film Hostiles alongside Christian Bale and Adam Beach. Studi is the first Native American presenter in recent memory. In addition to Hostiles, Studi appeared in Dances with Wolves, Last of the Mohicans, Heat, and Avatar, among others. With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by Canyon Records, producer of Native American music, including R. Carlos Nakai's million-selling Canyon Trilogy. All Canyon titles available from iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and CanyonRecords.com. Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. Our vision is to operate injury and accident-free with safety programs, training, and technology. More at BNSF.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Well, we've got someone in the studio now who's taking so many pictures you can't even keep track of them anymore, right, Mark? Mark Kelly's with us.
I am buried. My computer is buried. It's slowing up. I need to get them out of there.
It's a real problem in a way, right? I mean, you've had such a long career taking these beautiful, wonderful shots where you all here and locally have gotten spoiled seeing all your great work. But
thank you.
But you just have this huge library of it.
70,000 on my computer now, and those have been edited from the original suits, which would have been double that. So at some point in time, and this is in the last 10 years.
That's just digital stuff.
That's just digital. Yeah. That's in the last 10 years. So I've shot probably 150,000, and now we're down to 70, and I started whacking away at them. And I got rid of 5,000 in like 3 weeks, and that's not very...
And when you say got rid of, you just basically archive those and say, well, I'm not going to...
No, I actually dumped them.
You deleted them.
Yes, because I had another one, or they just weren't up to the necessary standards of today.
Okay.
But there have been some real gems in there that I found, like going, how did I ever miss these the first time around?
Sometimes you do so many different varied projects that I can imagine sometimes... You do something, and then when you look at them, you've got a certain project in mind, and maybe it just doesn't fit for that project. And then it maybe goes to the back of your mind, or...
Well, I'm always shooting so much, it just gets buried, and I'm just always, you know, the calendar's always number one, and that takes 26, for the two calendars, 26 images a year, and that's what I really focus on. And then when I'm working on a book project, like the Mendenhall, you know, I went through and sorted, I had 20,000 Mendenhall pictures. And in the edit to get the book down, I got them down to 10. But I still need to edit it. You know,
right.
There's no way I'm ever going to publish 10,000 pictures on the Mendenhall. I need to have like 200.
Right. So, and even that is that's a book.
That's a book.
Right.
Well, so it's just and the computer's slowing up, and the files are getting bigger. I used to be at 12 megapixels and 16 megapixels and 24 megapixels. Then 36, 37 megapixels. Now I'm at 47 megapixels per image. So
right.
They're huge files.
Huge files.
They eat up so much computer space.
But it allows for a lot of flexibility on how you use those images.
Oh,
right?
It's just the detail in a 47 megapixel image is
incredible.
Just
you
amazing.
Put it on the side of a building and
almost.
And so compare that to the old days when you had to, you know, you were dealing with a dark room and all that.
Well, you know, yeah, you know, you were printing them all.
Right.
And you know, 13 years of the Juno Empire in black and white. And just as I was leaving, they just started moving into color. I did the first color project ever at the Juno Empire, you know.
What was that?
Well, I think when I came here in 1979, we did a thing on the Mendenhall Glacier, and they did color that time.
Uh-huh.
But that was like we had to send it out, and, you know, we couldn't do it in-house. And then slowly I left in 93, so in the late 80s, early 90s, we started running color, and we could do it in-house. it was pretty sad for me, but we were learning. You know, it tracked the rest of the newspapers across the world.
I mean, right. Were you personally an early adopter of digital format,
no,
or did you come late to it?
I was very late. I didn't take it up until 2007. That was the year the iPhone came out. So I started with the iPhone, I guess.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't have one, but I mean, that's how. My phone number, my old home office number is 1993. That's the year I quit the newspaper. So always wanted to remember that date.
Yeah.
And I'm bad on dates.
Right, right.
So anyways.
So
we started moving, but we weren't doing color. We would do like 6 or 8 color projects a year. And now they're running color regularly, and they do a good job.
So when you and when you were working as a photographer during that period, what's the difference for you when you're looking at composition between knowing that it's going to be black and white or knowing it's going to be color?
You know, I've always liked color, and so I always wanted to do color, and I don't think I looked at it any differently.
Okay.
I mean, you can use color to separate. And then in black and white, you're using shades. And you always want the subjects to separate and so separation is a huge thing. And color is more variables, so you can work it so your items. What you want to see, what you're trying to tell the story about, that somehow separates out from the rest of the clutter.
Mm-hmm.
In black and white, it's hard. You only got you got an infinite number of shades. But you have those infinite number of shades now in all sorts of colors. And so it works to your advantage.
So people have seen and know so much of your work that you've done on the Mendenhall Glacier, and you're going to be doing a presentation tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, but you're not going to be doing it about the glacier, right? Because you want to look at other things, right, that you've been working on.
I'm doing it on what I call Alaska's Wild Wonders. I've been spending a lot of time out of Juneau over the last 3 or 4 years in Glacier Bay and in Denali and in other exotic Alaska, like the Arctic in the spring. I'm actually going to go up there for a while this spring to do Northern Lights. And I've done, this will be my third fireside chat, and both of them had emphasized pretty much Juneau, so I thought, God, I can't do Juneau
yeah.
again.
Well, that's all right, yeah.
So I thought, let's show these so everyone what I've been working on they haven't seen, and it's spectacular. I mean,
yeah.
Denali, I first went to Denali in 1974, so it's 42 years of going to Denali. I probably spent 5 or 6 months over the years, a week at a time in Denali.
Do you go to different parts of the park, or how do
I mostly just stay on the road system, which is 90 miles long, and. And because everything's accessible from the road, what I want to photograph, I haven't hiked Denali or anything romantic like that. It's just mostly a road warrior, and I can get lately I've been able, because I'm a professional, a wildlife photographer, a nature photographer, I can get a photo pass, and I can bring my own car and spend a week. They give you a week to just drive the road.
That's pretty. I actually in many years ago worked for Fishing Game, and I got to go do that 1 week. And it's ridiculous. I mean, it was so spectacular, right? It was just incredible.
Well, like, I usually go the last two, it's a lottery. So you apply, you have so many slots, and then the people apply, and then you have to meet the criteria that half your income comes from nature and wildlife photography. And then you go in a big pool, and they pull you out. So it's not a given that I'm going to get it. I qualify, so it's a lottery, and I got it 2 years in a row, and then last year I didn't, and it really hurt. Because what's so amazing is, if you know the system there, it's all on a buses. 99.999% of people have to travel on a bus, and you can understand it because the road is a disaster. I mean, it's a very dangerous road, and you just can't let everyone be running around, but they allow two photographers in their own personal cars in a week during the summer, and there are a couple weeks where they don't, so it's not a lot of added traffic. But everyone's leaving the back of the park, Wonder Lake, which is gorgeous, at let's say 8 or 9, and you're there, and the light's still up to 11. And basically, you're at you were at Old Faithful, at the best light of the year, of the day of the year, and there's no one there because everyone's left on the bus. You have the back of the park open to you from 10 o'clock at night till like 6 in the morning.
Right.
And those are the great hours. So I'm shooting from 10 to midnight, and then I'm up. I'm shooting all day, but the great light is then. And then I'm shooting, you know, from 3 in the morning till 10.
Yeah, what
and
time
I'm
of
the
year?
Only, this is mostly end of July.
End of July, okay.
First week of August.
Yeah.
So it's still pretty bright up there.
Right.
And it's just amazing. And there's no one on the last 20 miles of the road but me.
Yeah. You're really out there.
You got all these animals. You got all this light. And everyone's heading back. And the Rangers aren't on the road because there's supposedly no one on the road.
Right. Yeah. They're not worried about no missing persons or anything
right,
out
right,
there.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty amazing moment. And to be in that light and have it all to yourself is and to be in this space, probably one of the most beautiful places in the world. And you're just... You. Yeah,
right.
It's really fun.
Tell me a little bit about the Pribilofs.
Pribilofs was our first trip. Jan and I went there last year, kind of a combo, you know, husband-wife trip and just a birding trip and a hiking trip and then a photography trip. And it's amazing. It's, you know, it's 700 miles out in the middle of nowhere.
That's one thing. It's like it's so remote.
Right. You can't even find it. I mean, it's worse than a needle in a haystack. It's like contact lens in the haystack. You know, it's so hard to comprehend where. And you go look at the map, and you really have to get your magnifying glass out to find it. It's 700 miles. So you go get a little 30-seater plane, and it has the best legroom. I'm a tall guy, right? Like you, 6'5", you know, 6'4", shrinking and getting old.
Right.
and they have this big long exit row seat which I was able to get, and you put your leg up, and it's the raft that for the 200 miles, if you go down. So I got first dibs on the raft.
The raft. I'll take the raft seat.
So I got my legs out there. I'm fully stretched out. I'm as good as it gets. Anyways, you get out there and the birds are just amazing. Yeah.
Is there a quality of light that's out there that you found different? Or
no, we were there for 4 days in the end of June, and so you go through the Native Corporation out there. It's really hard. I mean, they have rooms for you to stay in. They have food. You eat at the processing plant. There's no restaurant.
Right.
And they have guides for you, and they have vans for you. So you just pay up. A bit expensive, but you just pay, mm-hmm. and you're well taken care of. And the birds and these guides know everything, you know, and they know all the back trails. And then we want to do a lot of hiking, which birders are classically, you know, just so focused, you know, they can't.
Right.
So we would spend half a day hiking and then half a day, you know, at the bird cliffs or whatever. And they loved it because we would just get all over the island. They have four-wheel tracks, everything, and their vans can go, and you just... It's just,
wow,
this treeless green emerald beauty.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So anyways, we'll show those pictures.
And then the other place that you're going to kind of concentrate on is Glacier Bay, which you've spent a lot of time in as well.
Yes. I first went in there in 1980 or 81 with Joel Bennett and John Howe. I was accompanying Joel we were camped at Tidal Arm in which is about mid-bay, and we went to John Hopkins for almost a week solid photographing seals in the ice. And we did that in late May, early June. I forget exactly when. And then I did a book on Glacier Bay, which came out in 2000. I spent almost 9 months in Glacier Bay starting in 1980. So that's like 36 years of Glacier Baying.
Wow. Has it markedly changed?
Well, you know, I came out with this book in 2000, and I kept reprinting. I think it sold almost 75,000 copies, which is a
awesome.
Lot of books.
Yeah.
And then last year or 2 years ago, I said no more. It had 16 tidewater glaciers in 2000, and now it's 9. We lost 7 tidewater glaciers in that 15-year span.
Wow.
It's a pretty remarkable retreat. A lot of people ask me, what has changed, and of course the glaciers receding, has also the regulations and like no one goes in. John Hopkins is this very sacred place. It's for seal. It's one of the major seal pupping areas in Alaska, And when we went in there, we just drove our Zodiac into the ice and hung out with the seals.
Yeah.
No one said boo.
Right.
We didn't know what we were. And then, but the trouble is the seal populations have been crashing and they were worried. So now they closed John Hopkins to all boat traffic until the 4th of July. And there's all sorts of new regulations about how close you can approach and stuff like that. So, it's gotten more popular, but still you can't put millions of people in there because it's a water park. And there's just not enough boats or not enough space. You know, the beach fringe is really critical. That's where all the animals hang out. And so if you're camping there, you're displacing birds, you're displacing, bears and all the conflicts arise. When I was doing the book, I was trying to talk to the park system into putting floating rafts that you could camp on. So you wouldn't go to that beach fringe. And, Glacier Bay, the cruise ships, you might hate them or love them, the part of the Park Service mandate is to get people in the park, right? And that gets people in the park, and they're in and out, and they haven't touched the beach fringe.
Right.
It's a really environmentally, probably people are going to shoot me for this very environmentally sound way of moving a lot of people in and out. If you put that same number of people on the beach fringe, the tidal area, the park's dead.
They'd have a huge impact, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
So it's an interesting compromise.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
I think that must be something you've seen through the years of photography in Alaska, the impact that people have had on the different places where
you've
gone.
Glacier Bay, for as long as I've been there, they've allowed two boats, large cruise ships, in their year. That's all it's permitted.
That's all it's ever been.
They never increased it. What's happened is a lot smaller, the 100-passenger, sea lions and those types have been getting permits. So there's more smaller ships in there like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really feel their impact. I mean, you go to the different – there are only a certain number of anchorages in there, and I've anchored at almost all of them. And, the most I've ever think is I've seen four boats in there with me at a busy anchorage, and usually there's one or two others. So it's pretty – still pretty wild.
Of the three places you're going to be talking about, this is an unfair question, but do you have a favorite? Do you have one that you just like, boy, that's such a special place, or that's – got such an interesting thing to work with in a photographic way?
No, I mean, I love the marine environment that represents Glacier Bay, and I love the Arctic, the tundra, taiga environment that is Denali. And the problem with, I've hiked in the Brooks Range, I've rafted in the Brooks Range, and that's all fine and good, and I love it, but it's the park road really and the no hunting has allowed the animals the access to it. I mean, you're up in the Brooks Range and you see a grizzly bear, you're not going to get within 3 miles of it. You're not going to get 3 miles of a sheep or anything.
Right.
You'd have to just get dumb lucky.
Right.
But in the park, they're used to it. And
they're
acclimated in a sense. They let you be in their space. You can't get up and pet them, but, well, I guess you could. You could.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Well, I'm not as wise as you.
Well, but it just makes it, as a photographer, an easier job. So, if you want to go see caribou, caribou are circumpolar. They don't exist anywhere else in the lower 48. So if you're American and say, hey, I want to see a caribou, Denali is the best place to see a caribou. I've never not seen a caribou alongside the road in Denali, You could go up the Arctic and run around for years and probably you would see a caribou. But, if you have a week or if you have 3 days, you're going to get to see a caribou.
Yeah.
And, Canada doesn't even have a park like that that is accessible for you to do that. So there really is a really neat thing about Denali and the road and the animals. And, the animals aren't stupid. The road's really easy to walk along,
Right. Yeah.
Instead of walking through this spongy tundra. I mean, they're very efficient at that.
Right.
So you can walk on a nice flat road. So
The thing that struck me about Denali that I just didn't know until I got there was just how massive that valley floor is. Just how deep and just how it seems to go on forever. And the way that you don't really even understand the scale you're looking at because Denali, the mountain, is so massive.
Right.
That it, coming from Juneau, it looks almost like Mount Roberts looking across the channel. but it's not. It's ten times as big.
What makes Denali so special? You know, it's not the highest mountain in the world, but it has the highest visible vertical rise. So that Denali, the North Face, which I think North Face equipment is named after, the North Face is famous, the Wickersham Wall, is almost, you see, 18,000 feet of vertical wall space.
Incredible.
You can't see that. You know, Everest does not have 18,000 feet. It's the largest vertical wall space you can see.
Right.
That's what makes the place so special. It's not that it's height. And then also, you know, as a climber, people think, well, Everest must be really cold, but it's kind of in the tropical zone. You know, it's around the equator. This is up in the Arctic, not very far from the Arctic Circle. That's why it's so damn cold.
Yeah, right.
And so harsh and windy and really a harsh environment, although I'm sure Everest is too.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, but it's only 20,000 feet compared to 29,000, whatever Everest is. And
right.
So you're 9,000 feet less, but it's just a harsher environment.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, it's fascinating to just talk to you about it. It's part of the presentation you're going to be giving tonight, Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, as part of the Friday Fireside Lecture Series. Two different lectures, 6:30 and 8 o'clock,
right?
And obviously for everyone listening, Mark's talks will sell out. So get there early and make sure you get a seat for this, what sounds like a really amazing talk. Mark, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about it, and have a great talk tonight.
Andy, thank you for having me.
Thanks
Appreciate
so much. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon, and Andy Klein with you, and been joined by Zach Brown and Tanya Lewis of the Indian Islands Institute. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
You guys have had some exciting few months here. Zach, we talked a number of months ago about kind of establishing this and all the work that you had done up to that point, but lots been happening this year.
Absolutely. It's a big year for Indian Islands Institute. We just had this milestone of actually purchasing the property. Some of the listeners might have heard of the Hobbit Hole out on the Indian Islands, where we're actually starting Indian Islands Institute, this field school. And we actually raised the whole $1 million to purchase that place, and that deal just closed last month. So we're pretty stoked. We're celebrating, and we're now it's time to get to work and really building out the school for education, science, sustainability, community.
Yeah. So, Tanya, tell me a little bit about that. You're the president of the Indian Islands Institute Board of Directors.
Yep,
is that correct?
That's correct.
And so tell me about, first, how you got involved in that, and then, secondly, what are some of the goals of the Institute?
Yeah, well, probably 3.5 years ago, Zach called me and asked if I wanted to be on the board, and I said yes. The Hobbit Hole is a location that I've spent a lot of time at. My family and I have caretaken out there, and it's a very special place. And the goals of the Institute, two of the main goals are environmental education, inspiring environmental leaders, and also scientific research and melding those two things, as well as sustainability, teaching people what sustainability means, and at being as self-sufficient as we can with subsistence activities, and then community. I've been involved in several weddings out there on the property, and yeah, it's just a great place. It brings people together because it is sort of this isolated place, you know, surrounded by a lot going on where Icy Strait meets Cross Sound.
Yeah, I was just going to say, just describe a little bit about where it is for people who don't know where the Hobbit Hole is. I think maybe everyone who's been in Juneau for a while has heard that term at some point.
Yeah.
This kind of magical place that's out there. But, you know.
Yeah, it is magical.
Yeah, describe where it is.
It's a small little archipelago of islands. Seven islands? Have you counted
something like that?
Seven,
depending
nine,
on how you
yeah.
want to count them.
And, you know, right where Cross Sound hits Icy Strait. So all the water for Lynn Canal and Glacier Bay comes through these really narrow passes on the north and south side of the islands.
And does that create that? I'm guessing that creates a really unique environmental location.
It does.
A lot of sea life, a lot of things coming through there.
Exactly. It creates rip-roaring tides, and it also means that all the biology, all the life is just funneled right through those passes there. So it makes it a really extraordinary place. It's a power spot. It's a place for that can really inspire people, too, and I think that's the goal.
You use the term field school. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is we're getting students outside the classroom. That's the idea. It's experiential learning, meaning learning by doing, learning with your hands, not just putting your brain in a jar and putting it in the classroom, but actually getting out there and learning on top of mountains, learning from glaciers, learning in kayaks, and that experience, I think, it really is a powerful form of education that sticks with you and that can actually, in some cases, change young people's lives and what they're going to do.
And what's is this a college kind of level course? Is it what are the age groups that are involved, or is it adults? Or tell me about who's involved and kind of would be going out there and actually learning.
Yeah, we can. That's one of the advantages of being we're an independent nonprofit organization, so we can really work with anyone we choose. We've had college level courses and high school level courses. We'll have both this summer, but we can also work with adult retreat type groups, and we can work with younger kids from local schools. And we want to do all of the above because I think this place has something to offer for everybody.
And in establishing an institute like this on a remote location, what kind of infrastructure goes into this? I mean, what are the things that, okay, if I was to establish an institute down here on 12th Street in town, I would need a building and I might need a car.
Yes.
What do you need out there to
the
keep this thing going?
The logistics are staggering. Luckily, we're starting with a few buildings. There's been a pair of brothers, fishermen, who have lived there for years and built up quite an infrastructure to begin with. Three houses, basically a shop, a dock, a hydroelectric system. So we're not starting from scratch, but just getting, you know, groceries out there, just getting people out there can be a huge challenge, you know, weather, especially in the winter. Getting students out there in the summer is a little bit easier. We tend to have, you know, better weather windows. But yeah, that is, we spend a lot of time working on logistics for getting work done out there and moving people and
yeah.
that sort of thing.
What's the jumping off community sort of? Are you coming out of Gustavus or?
Gustavus generally,
yeah.
but Juneau as well.
Yeah, right.
As far as flights, you know, flights out of Juneau
sure.
are sometimes easier to get than Gustavus.
Yeah. And so, so tell me a little bit about this shindig that's going on. So you've got a little bit
yeah.
of an event to celebrate this and let people know about it happening tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow night, 8 o'clock at the Red Dog. So we have been having a yearly fundraiser, as we call it, in Gustavus for the past few years. And when we bought the property last month, we decided we needed to have a bigger party, include a lot of our Juneau supporters, and really raise awareness, too, in the community of Juneau about what we're doing and people that might want to get involved and groups that might want to get involved in our efforts.
Yeah.
So I rallied a couple of my favorite bands, Rumblefish and high cost of living.
You
Gamble
know good
and high
people.
Cost of living.
You
yep.
know good people. Those are good, good bands.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we're going to have from 8 to 9:30 about Rumblefish is going to play. We're calling it a family set. If people want to bring their kids, they can. We're hoping to have a little contra dancing in there. Hopefully Jack will call a couple tunes out and real fun for the family. And then at 10 o'clock, the kids need to go home, and we'll party down with Gamble and the high cost
yeah,
of living.
Yeah, because cost of living's coming on.
Exactly.
And that's not for kids.
Right.
It's a fun show, though. Super fun show. Yeah, one of my both of those bands are great bands. So much fun they're gonna you guys are gonna have for that. But so I wanted to get back a little bit to the fundraising efforts that have happened already. What's happening to kind of keep the institute going? What are some of the funding sources that are gonna be the things that are kind of keeping this institute happening?
Sure. Well, we've been in capital campaign mode lately, which has been all about buying that property. That was a $1 million deal, and it had me traveling all over the country. We've got big supporters right here in Juneau that I really want to shout out to. The Juneau Community Foundation and a few funders who gave to our fund there, and Sam Skaggs with the Skaggs Foundation. That was huge. And we've got other Juneau supporters as well. But we a lot of this funding has also come from out of state, and so we have just a ton of people to thank. But now that we have the property, it is all about sustainability, sustaining the program in the long term. And that's going to be kind of a mix of the fundraising will never actually end, but there's going to be at a more modest level to maintain. We need to maintain the property. We need to pay staff, and so that's going to involve student tuition, fundraising, grants for science and for education, and then just we'll have probably a little bit of income also from tour groups and retreat groups and community events that are happening out there. But so it's going to be a mix. I think that one of the things that we teach is the ecological sciences, and in that there's a maxim that is diversity it leads to sustainability. And so we have diverse funding sources. Hopefully that's going to make us sustainable in the long
term.
Yeah,
it can apply to funding sources as well as other areas. Yeah. So is one of the next steps now, or is a step that you are now undertaking, kind of figuring out the schedule? I would think that would be like one of the things. Okay, this is when we're going to have this group in. This is when we're going to be doing this. We're going to bring in these teachers, that sort of thing.
That's right. There's a few groups, a few partnerships that we want to be kind of really core partnerships that happen every year. And then there's going to be all kinds of other events happening throughout the summer that I'm kind of consistently slotting events in here, there, and trying to make sure that the calendar works out for everyone, as well as myself as one of the main educators
right.
there on the ground.
And is it going to start this summer? I mean, it's starting this year as far as really cranking that up, or do you need a few months to kind of get the property in shape to do what it's changing mission, that property right now, right? So you're going to have to maybe make some adjustments to how it's organized, I would think.
That's right. There's a lot to do in taking a fisherman's homestead that's been operating in that way for over 40 years and making it into a flourishing field school. And so, but that said, we've already launched Indian Islands Institute and already ran 6 or 8 student courses out there. They've all been super successful. So, like Tanya said, we have a pretty good start on the infrastructure and the ability to host groups out there. That said, there's a lot to do. So this year is going to be kind of a bigger launch, still a soft launch. The entire summer is not going to be full because this is going to be our first time running it all ourselves with our own staff, our own boats. Hopefully, we're figuring it out a little bit by the seat of our pants. And then by 2019, 2020, we really hope to be filling the full summer and doing as much with this special place as we can.
Wow, it's an exciting project, and it must be, Tanya, I'm just thinking it must be really exciting to have come on 3 years ago, and now it actually kind of happened, right? like, really got it, coming from an idea to really the full fruition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were some times where we were a little scared, and I have to say, Zach had full confidence, and, I trusted that confidence, and it paid off. He pretty much raised the money, with a lot of help, but, it's pretty amazing.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to just the importance of this, the mission of the Institute and just the relevance right now with our environmental concerns in the world, and also the rise in technology that leads to an urbanization that leads to a lot of kids not even experiencing the outdoors in a meaningful way. And so that is, we hope to change that. That's one of our main missions is to inspire kids, young people, to care about the environment through research, traditional ecological knowledge, and actually subsisting gardening, catching fish, kelp, all that stuff.
Wow, so, yeah. Well, sounds like a good reason to celebrate. And Shindig's happening tomorrow, starting over at the Red Dog at what time?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock over at the Red Dog. And it's going to be a lot of fun. Gambling the High Cost of Living and Rumblefish playing the early show, and then High Cost of Living, Gambling the High Cost of Living coming in after that. Thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations, you guys, on getting this thing up and running and going, and it sounds like an exciting time for the Indian Islands Institute.
Thanks a lot,
Andy.
All right. We'll see you there.
Huh? Yeah, have a great party.
All right,
sounds good.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. It's easy to share a little of your PFD with Southeast communities through Pick, Click, Give. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
This is Bird Note. While it's still winter in many parts of North America, it's summer in Antarctica. And the birds are singing. At least, the penguins are. A pair of king penguins stands face to face. They tilt their heads back, point their long bills skyward, and trumpet in unison. Second largest of all penguins, king penguins stand nearly 3 feet tall. They're surprisingly colorful, too, with a bright oval of lustrous orange-yellow adorning the back half of their dark heads. Some king penguins form breeding colonies that number in the tens of thousands, and when many pairs tip their heads back and sing, it sounds like the world's largest kazoo band. Altogether, more than 2 million king penguins nest on islands in the Southern Ocean, the sea that surrounds Antarctica. Their breeding cycle ranks among the longest of all birds. From the time the female lays her single egg in late spring, it'll take about 14 months before that chick is ready to fend for itself the following summer. We hope, with a loud send-off from the immense kazoo band. Writers for Bird Note include Bob Sundstrom, Ellen Blackstone, and Dennis Paulson. I'm Michael Stein.
And welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and I've been joined by Bobby Lewis, Eustace Johnson, and Ryan Shaw. They're all joining me here from the Gospel Workshop that's been happening all week here in town, and then performances are coming up. So Has it been a good group? Been a fun time this time around?
Amazing. Yeah. We have so much fun. And then in between eating all these great restaurants, it's just perfect.
The restaurant scene in Juneau is on point, right?
It really is on point.
And,
yes.
It's definitely on point.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, it's good to be back.
Now, have you guys been up as well before? Eustace, have you been here before as well?
Yes, I've been here 7 years now.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I've been coming up with Bobby.
You've been coming with Bobby.
Yeah,
this is my first year.
And Ryan, it's your first year to come up. All right, well, what's your impression of Juneau as a first time coming up?
Stunningly beautiful.
Okay, there you go. That's the answer we wanted. That's why I asked. Well, tell me a little bit about how the week has gone so far. What do you, when you come in, you kind of, it's like boot camp for gospel singing, right?
Yes,
so.
it is amazing. It's this Black History Month celebration of the trip that the slaves took from Africa all the way over to Virginia, and we take that journey, and I'm teaching them spirituals. It's really a history lesson. We're learning the African-American spirituals and gospel music and becoming an even better community here, because I always hate to say black history. It is American history, and we make it a part of our history, and we grow together, learn music for this big concert on Sunday, and it's the best thing.
I didn't quite realize that you went through that journey while you're teaching it, that you kind of started with the...
Oh, yeah. We go from 1661 on up to Martin Luther King at the Lincoln Memorial.
And then how does that, from a musical standpoint, how do you feel like that informs how people end up singing even the modern day...
Well, I'm glad you asked. Because, you know, when the slaves were brought over, all they had was music. And it's that African drum that spilled into pop music, rock and roll. You know, we believe it's the basis of so many genres of music. So that inspiration of the music that gets them through the pain of being property. And, you know, having no rights and having a bill of sale connected to your name. But the only thing that was their own was the music on the inside. And that was their inspiration, which is like today. We go to work feeling like we're somebody else's property until we knock off, you know. And music has a way of just changing your reality, your perception. And we talk about how that music was medicine, you know, keeping them from falling into Great Depression and mass suicides, you know. So we use that music, and we use it to inspire us today. And before you know it, when people walk in there at 6:30, I love the first night, because especially the newbies, because, you know, we've been coming 7 years now. We have 80% is just repeats. But that 20% is like, what is going on right in this room? And some of them signed up for just to hear a lecture on the genre of the spiritual, not knowing they're going to be like, altos, sopranos, tenors, basses, you know. And when you leave, it is like, what just happened to us?
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
It really is wonderful. So by Sunday, you're looking at a family, a community that's taking you through the story. We're literally reading the narrations, and in between, a beautiful spiritual will come out and a gospel song, and, you know.
Right.
So it's really wonderful.
That's awesome. Eustace, tell me a little bit about your role as this develops and as the week goes on.
Well, I'm the accompanist on piano.
Oh, okay.
And I accompany.
When you're accompanying someone on piano who's a beginner versus someone who's experienced, how do you adjust how you accompany to do that?
It's sort of a give and take thing. You sort of feel the energy from them, and it's, you know, I give them energy, they give me energy. It's a reciprocal effect.
Yeah. Is there ways that you kind of give them assists and that kind of thing?
I try.
And then Ryan, what's your role there?
Well, this week I'm coming as a guest artist.
Okay.
And so I'm actually a member of Pastor Bobby's church, but I'm also a recording artist. And so Bobby, I came down actually in 2012 was my first time with Bobby, but we were in Fairbanks.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
So he's like, you got to come back in the winter. We were there for the Summer Arts Festival. He said, you have to come back in the winter so you get to see Fairbanks again and Juneau. He's like, Juneau is ridiculous and you're going to love it. And so he invited me down as special guest artist. So I'll be singing as featured artist in the Motown show that's tonight. And I'll be singing three songs with the choir on Sunday.
And then where do you typically live?
New York based.
New York. Okay, yeah. So winter's not. I was going to say if it's southern or you know Phoenix or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. Okay. Oh, are you okay? Yeah. So. All right, yeah. It's like, come back in the winter. Like, yeah. I don't know, Bobby. I'm not sure if I'm going to come back in the winter.
Well, Fairbanks had a heat spell this trip, so it was like only like -9. So
not so bad.
That was not so bad.
Oh, man. Still sounds pretty bad. So tell me about the kind of – so tonight's Motown night.
Tonight is Motown. I brought Ryan because he's a three-time Grammy nominee artist, and he also was – Stevie Wonder on Broadway in Motown Live,
the musical.
So I said, you got to come and be our special guest in Juno. So he is going to rip it up tonight with myself, and I have two local artists that sing with us, Bobby Mitchell and Alyssa. Fisher. And they join us with one of the professors from Fairbanks, the University of Fairbanks, Janelle Solaire. And we are singing all together, passing the mic, singing back up, and so. But then he comes in and just rips the place apart. And it's a lot of dancing and fun. It's really great.
There's more performances throughout the weekend then as well, right?
Yes, so
then
we do. What? Motown tonight, and then on Sunday we do two shows. A 2 o'clock gospel journey, and then a 5:30. It's at the Jack, and they're packed, so we have to do two shows.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah,
that's what happens.
Exactly.
When you're good.
Oh my goodness.
And is this something that you do across the country?
Oh, we travel. Now I'm a senior pastor in Harlem, but in between I travel. We travel. Like we're leaving here March 6th, and we go to Spain, and we do a big tour over there in Spain, and come back. So we're constantly traveling.
And you kind of bring a different group of people, or do you guys kind of go as a unit?
I travel with about 12 people.
Okay.
When we travel that way, we do more like concerts. We do the concerts, but when we travel, just to do workshops, it's only Eustace, my musical director, and myself, and we go and. People sign up, and then we teach music. And
have there been places that you've shown up that you were kind of like just surprised by the reaction or how well people, or that it started awkward and went better? Are there things like that?
Every time we go somewhere, it is like, what's going to happen?
Right.
Who's coming into this room? You know?
Yeah.
And the same on their side. There is a fear in their eyes.
You think there's a real fear?
What is it? It's unknown. What is it? And then once we experience each other, it is like, it's a rocket. It goes off. And people start learning. Because I don't think people understand how gifted they really are. You know, you just have an understanding of, I do this, and that's it. But when you come into a room and somebody teaches you another form or an art, and you do it, and you join other people, and the sound that's happening in that jack, they're looking at each other and it's like, did we just do that? And it is really amazing.
Yeah,
you know,
I can
really
imagine.
Is amazing. So the journey is on both sides. I don't know what's going to happen, and they don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
But by the end of the night, we are hugging and laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's really wonderful.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing to think about.
And,
When you start with Motown, that's sort of starting from the culmination of what people understand as popular about this, right?
Yes.
And then you kind of work your way back as far as the performances go.
Oh yeah. Motown is just one big dance party, a celebration of the music that everybody knows.
Right.
You know, it's like they wrote some of the music we hear today will never be heard again after 5-6 years, but when you hear boom, 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 everybody knows what that is, you know.
Right.
So it is a cultural music that has crossed generations. And so we love celebrating the Motown music. And then on Sunday, we'll go from spiritual Still Away all the way up to some of the recent gospel music to see journeys of music, you know.
What has been the development in more recent kind of traditional gospel music over the past, say, 50 years?
Well, you know what's so funny is that every generation, when new music comes, it's hard to receive. You know, like we just had an artist that just died, Edwin Hawkins, and he wrote a song in the 70s. It's called Oh Happy Day. When he wrote that song, it was... churches would not even let him come in because they're like, that's the devil's music. Don't bring the devil's music. But even Bach and Handel, they were treated, when they brought their new forms of music, that was evil. You couldn't bring it in the church, you know, but we grow and it becomes our foundation. Now, wherever we sing Oh Happy Day, we're going to Spain. When we sing Oh Happy Day, they don't know what the words mean, but they know every word.
they know that song, yeah.
Yeah, so we just show how music just transcends, you know. And when you first hear it, it's hard to, like, you know, people say Justin Bieber. Oh, what is this? But now everybody loves him.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But when you start off, it's always something new. It's hard to get it. But when it really is good music, it'll stick.
Yeah. Ryan, has this been a part of your life, your whole life, the gospel music? Or is it something you came to a little bit later?
No, I grew up singing in church. My mother's like a Southern Pentecostal minister. I always say my mother's a Southern Pentecostal minister and my father's the devil.
No, but it's an old story.
No, but I grew up singing in church. And from the moment we could talk, we joined what they call the Sunshine Band.
So you kind of don't remember a time of not having music be an absolute part of your life, I would say.
No, there was never a time. And until we were out of our mom's house, we still had to go to church every Sunday. And then once we became 18, we had to go to somebody's church. It didn't have to be hers.
So when you made the move to New York, was it something that you immediately wanted to find that base? You immediately wanted to find that? Or is
no.
it something that you kind of...
No, I kind of moved
getting
to New
away
York.
From a little
yes.
bit. Yeah,
I moved to New York to get away from everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I guess to sort of sow my wild oats, if you may. And then one morning, I remember maybe like a year and a half or 2 years in, I woke up and I was like, Lord, I want to get away from like the religion of the church, but I didn't want to get away from you. And then at that point, that's when I decided to go to church regularly and go back to my relationship with God and not.
In your own spirituality,
yeah,
you found it in,
yeah.
in the church.
And in a
yeah.
very unique church, which is New Light, which is Pastor Bobby's church, actually. It's not like any church that I've ever experienced. And it's pretty cool. So if you're ever in New York, you know, look us up.
Thank you for the invitation. I'd love to.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
New Light Baptist Church. In Harlem.
.com.
Exactly.
Well, exactly. It's always wonderful to have you in, Bobby.
Yes.
Thanks so much. And thanks to you gentlemen for coming in as
Thank
well.
You. You're welcome.
Once again, the Motown is happening tonight, 7:30.
Yes. 7:30 at the Jack.
At the Jack. So jahc.org is where you can get information. I think get tickets probably still, but tickets
yeah.
at the door maybe as
yeah,
well.
You can
I'm
get
guessing.
Out the door. Yes, you can.
Okay. And then remind us one more time of the show.
On Sunday at 2 p.m. and at 5:30 second show. So you can get those tickets. When you get your tickets for Motown, get your tickets for Sunday, too, while you're there.
It sounds great.
Yes.
Thanks so much, and thanks for coming
Thank
in. It's
you.
The Gospel Singing Workshops that's been happening all week, and you'll get to hear the fruits of their labor tonight for the first time, 7:30 p.m. at the Jack. Thanks so much for coming in.
Awesome.
Have a great show.
Thank you.
Stevie Wonder there. It's a great First Friday happening. Go out there. There's a whole ton of stuff going on. And I know there's an Ales for Tales event happening over at the Downtown Depot that's going to be a benefit for GHS. There's First Friday events happening all over town. Don't let the wind hold you back. It's going to be fun out there. See all the great art and all the great businesses that are downtown that stay open and do so much for this downtown community. Head over to the Jack tonight and hear great gospel music as well, like this Stevie Wonder. Thanks, everyone, for joining us for Friday edition of A Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, signing off.
This one thing I find so true.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.